So hello and welcome to the latest episode of Design Truth. Two episodes in 1 week is pretty unheard of around these parts, so do make the most of it whilst it's here. My name is Brad, and me and my design mate Drew catch up with the different lived experiences and perspectives within the world of industrial design. Today we're joined by Paul Diath to unpack the divide between industry and education. I'll let Paul explain who he is and what he's about shortly. If you do enjoy the podcast, as always, share it with a design pal of yours and leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. I'm now going to leave you to some funky intro music, and I'll see you on the other side. How are things in your world, Paul, at the minute? How is it going?
Absolutely mad. Yesterday was probably, I hope, the last day of the absolute chaos that has happened over these last few months. It's been, I actually managed to spend some time with the students last night, yesterday afternoon. They've had a really tough year, but I think what I spent a lot of time telling them as well was just how tough we've had it as staff as well, because it's just trying to get people through this has been the biggest task. And the same with families. How do you get children to understand what's going on? How do you get your elderly parents to understand what's going on? It's just been a relentless sort of sharing, collaboration, and just helping each other through. So exhausting is probably the best way of putting it.
I hear that. We're having to self-isolate at the moment, We're coming up, I think tomorrow's the last day, so I've had my two daughters here and working from home, and you're not allowed out past the back garden, so it's again a sudden rule change. And yesterday I woke up tired, I stayed tired, and I woke up till I was asleep. It's horrible.
I was very sort of frustrated and disappointed because a week ago I had to isolate. I've been double jabbed, which was always a pleasant experience. And I think I did my first social thing in 16 months on the Saturday. I woke up on a Sunday morning saying, you need to isolate for 8 days. What did I do yesterday? Of course, it wasn't the day before. It was several days before that. And it turns out several other members of staff also had to self-isolate, which was really frustrating because our physical show was going to happen 3 days later. Right. So I could only join it on the very last day. And how do you explain to the students that I'm really sorry, but I have to self-isolate? Mm-hmm. They're not that interested in whether or not you self-isolate, really. We've all having to do it. They're all doing it themselves. It's just become a normal behaviour. So it was very, very disappointing to not be there for the opening day as such. But fortunately, I got there for the final day, and it was great. I think one of the things you have to learn is that the location services on your phone track you to just about anywhere you could possibly be. And I still don't know why I had to isolate. I still don't know. Well,
If someone's listening and they know why Paul needed to isolate, then please do send a message to leave it in the comments below. Hello at designtruth.co.uk.
and that person that licked my face that time. I can't quite remember
exactly. If you did lick his face, then please do drop a message to hello at designtruth.co.uk.
The problem is with whoever licked that person.
Yeah, there's a whole new social etiquette going on here, isn't there?
Exactly. This is a very new podcast episode series for us. So, it would be great is if I know you're vaguely familiar with the podcast, Paul. But it'd be great if you could just introduce yourself, not just from the kind of the fact that you are within the world of design education, but maybe just give a bit of context to life before that, and just kind of sum up what's kind of got you to this point.
Yeah. So what has got me to this point? That is a very, very, very long story. I try to keep it very short. I started my career in both a very difficult time and at the same time very fortunate. I originally studied automotive design at Coventry University. And we came out of that period. That was a fairly serious recession. There were very few jobs. And, you know, I still look back on it and feel how lucky I was to get my first role. And I was in consultancy for, I think, the first 15 years of my career. And the great thing about the consultancy was just how many different clients you worked for. But I do remember a couple of things. There was a moment, it was about 3 years in, where I was working at one of the now gone but very well-known consultancies in London at the time. And I just had that moment through working with some colleagues who were all Royal College educated. I suddenly understood why design mattered. And it was all about engagement with people, now called human-centered design. At the time, when you come out of an automotive course, that kind of human-centered design aspect wasn't really part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I suddenly recognized just how much influence as a designer one could have over the things, the spaces, and the things that we create. I moved through a range of consultancies, including a period where I ran my own business, mainly designing transportation and toys. Was named Transportation and Toys. Because it just seemed a little bit kind of niche. Put the two together in the great world.
A diverse pair of industries to pick.
Just treat every single person traveling on public transport like a child, and you've probably got a good way to respond. It got to a point where I went through that whole phase where lots of the agencies were being bought up by some of the big sort of WPPs of this world. And that's exactly who ended up buying the company I was working for. And I recognized then that, and you see it happening now as well with a lot of the management consultants buying up design agencies. Mm-hmm. I just saw the importance that design had to business at the time. And I found myself in a increasingly sort of leading major projects for clients and finding it becoming more and more strategic. I then was lucky enough to be approached to work at Samsung Design Europe and pulled in there as sort of the strategic manager. And that team really grew. It's a fantastic, started up a few years before, but it was a real education in terms of how the corporate world operates from at a design level. And, you know, I've really felt that I found my niche there. Although it was tough, there's no doubt on that world with the attitudes and the hierarchies that it wasn't an easy place to work, but it was an extremely enjoyable place to work. And off the back of that, I had a period, then sort of chose to transition across to much more of a digital environment. We'd been increasingly at Samsung going more and more digital. So I ended up working at Telefonica for a couple of years, leading their UX design team out of London. Particular focus on communications, but part of the bigger Telefonica digital UX team run by a lady called Pamela. Which brings me full circle to the education side of having had my education university, having had quite an experience there and wondering what it was all about, I was actually asked, I took voluntary redundancy from Telefonica, and I was thinking about what to do next. Had some really interesting conversations with companies and kept finding myself in a bizarre situation where every interview I went for, there seemed to be five other people applying, all with MBAs. And that was kind of an insight that design had got to the point where it had true value for business. Mm-hmm. And that's why most of these big companies are now asking for design-educated candidates. But while I was fishing around and interviewing, of course, it was quite at that point. I'm getting quite old, so there were fewer roles. And I was asked if I would just step in here for a year just to look after one of the stages, because they thought it might be quite handy to have someone with some particular knowledge of industry. But equally, for me, it wasn't an altruistic process. It wasn't, oh, I really want to give something back. I'm afraid I don't really like that phrase. I wasn't thinking about giving back at all. It was just sort of, that could be quite enjoyable, you know, fresh minds, meeting a whole range of new people. And also the fact that I seem to spend more and more time during my career managing people and trying to get the best from them. And it just struck me that there was a moment where I could maybe do that in a different environment. And that's when I joined here. And then I found myself being asked if I would consider taking on course leader role, which I kind of chose to. And that's it. I've been here since. So,
and you're at CSM, are you?
That's Central St. Martin's. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's, I think, the oldest course ever, the running. I don't think several people make claims. I think there was a design course here back in 1936. So, yeah, it goes way, way back. But
what was it called then? I mean, we've had this chat about what do we call ourselves?
Creativity.
I remember when I was studying, it was product design, and that was understood. But now a product design role might be for designing bank accounts or, insurance or something digital. So now we've got this industrial design thing. Was that? Can you hear the alarms outside my window?
Yeah, we can hear them. Yeah, good.
Just checking.
What did you do?
What did I do? Well,
there's no fire in the house.
Which one? I just want to say there's quite a lot to unpack there. There's a lot of different kind of buzzwords which fit into a storyline of design. So you're talking about some of the big consultancies at the time, and then human-centered design and how that's come in, and then there was digital, then there was UX. I felt like it was sort of plotting a course of like the last maybe 20 years. Forgive me if I'm off on the timelines, but of buzzwords that I think I've picked up and most of the industry has as well. You know, there's always a new focus, a new thing that everyone's going to get onto their CV. So it's just interesting to hear that sort of laid out.
And if I was a different type of person, I would perhaps communicate that in a way that was always a destiny. And I do appreciate that with some people, that they're very good at retrospectively telling a story about their career progression. Look, I'm very open and honest with it. It's situation. I was just saying to the students yesterday, when you come out and you get offered a job, if someone offers you a job, take it. I mean, you either do or you don't. And if you do, it's going to lead to another thing. And you'll just find yourself in a path that takes you through all sorts of potential opportunities. That's what happened to me. I never predicted to be running a course around product and industrial design at all. Just didn't even occur to me. I never expected to be. I mean, how would one predict a company such as Samsung and the huge growth they had? Mm-hmm. I vaguely remember this new startup. This not startup, but a new company called LG Life's Good as being kind of a potential client at one point. Mm-hmm. Thinking, what's going on here? You know, it's not as if I was having this amazing vision about the future or anything. It just things happen and you work with it. You try to understand the situation as much as you can and look for those opportunities to make improvements, enhance things.
Right place, no right time. Right.
There are some people who seemingly outwardly at least give the impression that there's a plan and they're on a trajectory and that they've got it all mapped out. They know what's coming out next. And it might just be that if you're more like me, by the sounds of it, yourself as well. It's just that sounds fun. Let's do that. And that sounds good. And you get this storied past where there was no intended narrative anyway. But it's nice to look back on it and go, oh yeah, no.
Yeah. Obviously, right. It that looks fun. I mean, it sounds it's such a sort of broad way of explaining it, but. You get excited about opportunities. If you don't get excited by the opportunities, then don't bother. You know, I think most creatives are genuinely optimistic. I'll keep it as a short story, but we had a show here for a few years. Over 3 years, we're trying to promote all the different students' work across so many of the different disciplines. You know, the fine artists, graphic designers. And there was kind of themes evolving. And the head of college at the time had met Howard Jacobson, who'd said that there is no such thing as an intelligent optimist. The idea being that if you're intelligent, you can see all the doom and gloom as well in the world. Therefore, you're going to be rather pessimistic. And as I understand this, how the story goes, was that Jeremy thought, well, that's not right, because surely all the artists and designers in the building, the people that were helping with their education, are intelligent optimists. They're using the information they have around them to look at a positive way of moving forwards in society. And so we actually built a whole exhibition around the idea of intelligent optimists. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that fun, you know, if you're optimistic, you're going to enjoy things that come your way. You're going to feel enthusiastic. And I think that's perhaps one of the core attributes of the students, is if they have enthusiasm and optimism, that makes them employable because they have an excitement for the future. They've got the skills. I mean, the skills are there. We can teach skills day in, day out. But if you have the optimism and the enthusiasm and the ambition, then that seems to make a difference to the opportunities that come their way.
Yeah. Is that one of the big learnings as well going into education, that actually you're not at, so a big part of the job is to, of course, teach the fundamentals of how to become a better designer, but you're actually teaching someone how to be a better person or a better communicator. You're in a stage of their life, I don't know if you remember being 18, 19 again, Drew, but actually what a lecturer is doing is not just educating you on how to get half decent a key shot. They're also teaching you about the person and helping mold you as a human being. Do you see that as a big part of your job as much as?
Yeah. It's an interesting time at the moment. There's a few things that we're doing that you think are blurring the boundaries between education and therapy. I really won't go into detail, but every now and again you sit there and think, now, is my role right now to be your personal therapist, or is it to encourage you to start getting on with the process of designing? Mm-hmm. Every student has their own set of issues that they are dealing with. It's called growing up.
Is this a post-COVID thing, by the way, or just because you...
No.
Okay, so this is
It's worse because of COVID, there's no doubt. Okay. But I've been here, this is my sixth year. It's been there the whole time.
Okay.
The other side of you, it's my argument here is that if you look at some highly creative individuals, artists through designers, you look at the people who've been fantastically successful, who've had something to say about the world around them, invariably it's because they have a different perspective. That might be because they have had some kind of trauma or situation they've been through that makes them look at the world differently. Sometimes that can be around sort of neurodiversity. You might see things in a different way. And that can be a real advantage as well. So I think the role of the educator has really been trying to understand the unique perspectives and then putting them into context of how that matters in a creative environment. We actually have a creative attributes framework, which talks about 9 different attributes sitting under kind of 3 main categories. And in reality, all design courses are helping not necessarily teach those attributes, that enable students to recognize those attributes that they are building through the process of studying design. And it's those attributes that make the difference at the end, for sure. I do think easily 30% of the time is really about attributes. The other 70% is skills. But I can see it's shifting as we go through. And COVID has probably just pushed it more towards dealing with the aspects that affect people's personal attributes.
Do you find you have to do quite a bit of reading and study around those areas then for your own education in order to be able to coach?
I'm not great at reading. I can read, just to make that clear, I can do it. I'm one of those people that are always looking forwards. It's just purely a personal story. I tend not to look backwards too much. There's a great advantage to looking backwards to be able to track patterns. And there are times in particular aspects of design where that's really useful, particularly when you're looking at color trends, etc. But I tend to always want to be looking ahead, less about reporting and more about prediction. So I haven't read a great deal around it. Yes, there have been times I have read a variety of sort of books around psychotherapy and how does one build sort of personal goals. A whole series of books, the whole sort of chimp on the shoulder one, I think, is it Martin Seligman? I can't remember. But the reality is the university is very good at giving additional training to be able to help you understand the context of the situation that students are in. Mm-hmm. So we have had that, creative mindsets, workshops, a whole series of understanding of how behaviours can manifest in different ways. So, yeah, there's been some training there as well, for sure. But at the same time, it's useful. But what we mustn't forget is the focus for education is to get the students in a position where they feel confident about the world that they're going out into, and that they have the skills and the attributes to be able to make a difference through working effectively. Mm-hmm. I'll come back to the same point. It's consistent, continually trying to work out where that boundary is between all the skills of the educational, of academia, versus the support and pastoral care that goes with it as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like providing the support and the confidence and the background to be able to go and really fully immerse themselves in the skills and in learning and in practicing and in refinement. I mean, just as that's one thing I'm taking away from it.
Yeah. What's the quickly, just before we kind of move on to the bulk of the topic, what's the mood of the students at the minute? If you could put it into one or two words, are they confident? Are they not confident? Is it a mixed bag? How are they feeling?
It's always the same. There's a certain amount of trepidation. Where do I go next? Again, mentioning it yesterday, there's going to be an anticlimax. We'll know this. So you put all your heart and soul into something for several months, and then it stops. You've then got to deal with it. So it's a natural process now of a certain amount of an anticlimax. At the same time, I would say across the majority of the students, a certain amount of optimism. And I'm seeing it from industry as well. There seems to be a renewed optimism for how design can have an impact, particularly now post-COVID as well. So, I genuinely believe at the moment it's a pretty good time to be a designer. I think it's particularly now, and I'm sure they do feel, on the whole, optimistic about the future. But, on a day-to-day basis, you can have your moments.
Just quickly, just to pick up on that point, it being a good time to be a designer, I mean, you have the ear of most of the design industry.
I know a few of them, yeah.
You've got quite a few contacts, let's say. What's your take on that?
Good question. I put the recruitment hat on about a week ago, started to network in that capacity again. And I'm with you in optimism. I think one of the main challenges is at the minute it's very different from company to company, because I think each different product vertical you go into is going through a unique challenge, whether it's, we can't access the raw materials, or retail's gone down, so we need to invest heavily in e-commerce, or I can give you an example of a stairlift company where you're thinking, okay, stairlifts, business is going to be booming, care home crisis. Actually, their sales methodology is traditionally door to door, and you can't go door to door. So there's so many different things that each business is going through, which does wrap your head as a designer. Well, how can we actually kind of fix that? So I think one of the main interesting points now are companies are going, okay, are we going to double down on current products, or are we going to invest heavily in new product development? What's the market going to look like in 2 years' time once these things actually reach market? And are we going to invest in the tooling now? Because, in 6 months' time, what's the world going to be looking like then? I think that's a big challenge that companies are going through at the minute, where it's like, do we invest in new product development? Are our customers going to be buying these products in X period of time? And that's a definite quandary that a lot of businesses are going through at the minute, where it's, do we invest? Do we take what we've got? And that's across all different product verticals. But I do think there is a definite growing optimism around the industry, and lots of vacancies are happening. Definitely more appetite to hire juniors in, I suppose, now we're going into a studio again on a more regular basis, so it's far more appropriate now to be employing junior designers. But that's probably the biggest challenge, if I was to put a slight negative slant on it, is do we invest in new product development, or do we double down on what we've got at the minute? But I'm sure someone can eloquently talk about that in a bit more depth, but that's what I'm hearing on the ground while we're running.
It's open as well. It's just something that been recently announced at the time of recording, that any of the government protection, done, you're on your own. I know the pandemic's still going, but it's on you now. what kind of effect is that going to have on, I suppose, well, for two things. One, the job market. Do you think a lot of people will decide, well, I'm not going back into the office, I'm going to stay home, if that means a change of position, fine. And for you, Paul, like, what does that mean for next year's students?
Do you want to go first, Paul?
in terms of practicalities, Drew.
I'm freaked out. I work from home, have done for the entire of the since before the lockdown, and I'm quite comfortable with it. I've had the request to start commuting to the office. Actually, the job that I'm doing now, I've never been to the office. It's about a 2.5 hour drive from where I live. I don't see any value in doing it because of the type of work that I'm doing. But I don't feel like I have any real recourse to say, no, that's nonsense. Mm. I'm not doing it. Mm. I'm sure there's probably plenty of other professionals that feel the same way. But I mean, from students looking at, they're going to leave home next year, or maybe they're already on the course and things are going to change again. What's your just immediate thoughts on that?
So I was listening quite intently to, not this summer, but last summer, we were running, we're called designer profile sessions on Tuesday nights. So we'd invite people in to talk about their design careers. Very lucky to have retained so many contacts in the industry, and so many people were happy to give their time. Quite a few of them are saying, well, I'm sat here on my own at home. It's quite nice to talk to other people, talk about their careers. So what I heard as the main story from most of those people who spoke was that those that were heavily involved in the design industry were missing the studio culture. Mm. It was a consistent story that although we can work this way, is it really helping our cause? How often do you just pick up on someone's comment who's just sat next to you or near you, and you're not involved in the conversation, but you're absorbing at least maybe a sense of direction or an insight that you can just utilize for whatever you're doing at that moment in time. So they're all saying that the studio culture is really important. From an academic perspective, or at least from an establishment perspective, institutional perspective, we've made it very clear that students have to be back next year. There's a small exception in there. Some people won't be able to. But next year, we will be expecting students to make the most of the facilities that we provide here. Doesn't mean we're going back to how we were before. Because there have been some amazing learnings over this last year. Some real benefits in some of the digital tools have really helped with the relationship between staff and students.
Okay.
We are very clearly saying now that the studio culture matters. And the ones the students have just left here pretty much last night, they came back in here Easter. There was tangible improvement in attitude and sense of enthusiasm. Also, it's notable on the impact it's had on the quality of the work that has come out. There is an absolute direct correlation. So, I think we need people to be back and sharing a space. There'll still be a degree of distancing and everything else. We're still being cautious, but I think design agencies, design companies, and sort of design institutions like this all need to get people talking to each other, mm-hmm. or at least collaborating together in a sensible space.
Yeah. I'd agree with you there. I think from a hiring angle, the big thing around remote working that I maybe we weren't doing it long enough, is that if you're in the early stages of your career, I don't see how you can advance up the ladder in your back bedroom.
No.
Anyone, I think that's the thing. Ironically, I was talking to a designer about a week or so ago, someone that listens to the podcast. I won't name their name because their boss will be listening as well. And he was talking about how he's been remote working for a long period of time, so pre kind of COVID. And it's like, well, it's kind of, my career's not really going anywhere. I'm doing the job, I'm taking my wages, but it's not really going anywhere anymore. I've stalled.
Yeah.
And that's what I think will start to happen over the next 12, 18 months, is that careers will, they'll be like, okay, I'm not really moving anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. I'm still doing the same job I was doing before. My salary is probably going to be the same as what it was before. So anyone with real ambition at the early stages of their career will be, I don't think it necessarily works for. But I think those that have perhaps worn the T-shirt a little bit, safe pair of dependable hands, I think remote working is a fantastic option and it's something you could definitely utilise. But I do think that there will be a return to an office. But I don't think it'll be 5 days a week. I'm still not necessarily, I believe that it will be complete 5 days a week.
I hope that's the one thing we take away, is just the flexibility. You know, and that people have got different commitments in their life outside of work, and that, you know, the school runs to do, and there's just any number of things that can impact where you need to be on a given day, as well as I need to be in the studio or I need to be in an office to, you know, to mix with other people.
Yeah.
I think we take away great.
What is an interesting dynamic, Drew, is that I found that you can talk to design, maybe not so much now, but definitely 12 months ago, where it's like, well, I just want something completely remote. Almost now the employee is now in charge of the employer, almost dictating what the terms are of their contract. I think that's a really interesting kind of scenario we found ourselves in, where the actual designer, it's not just design things, it's beyond our industry, they're almost dictating what the employment terms are, whereas they're not the actual person that's paying the wages of this. And it's a very interesting scenario where even like, I've seen lots more CVs now that come through and there's no address on their CV anymore. It's almost like they've taken it off their CV. And like, why have you taken it off? You know, they still need to see that you can get to the studio at a short notice. They need to know what the train lines are into that, you know. So it's just funny how things like that are starting to kind of creep in. And I do think over the next 12 months now, you know, rightly or wrongly, we are kind of going back to what life was like before. I do think the employer will start to take a bit more charge of that process of, these are the terms. You either, you know, we're happy to, for a little bit of flexibility, you know, you need some CAD, get on with it at home. But I do think that charge will start to go back into the arm of the employer. It's been a very interesting kind of experience talking to people over the last 12 months about the whole remote working piece.
Add just something sort of anecdotal here as well. It goes back to 2010 or 11. As the Samsung office was growing, we had to keep changing offices. We needed a bit more space. And so we ended up looking at where we should move next. And that's a design project in itself. What's the environment we're trying to create? What kind of attitude we want in the building? How can you spark creativity with the right type of environment? And so you're going through all this effort to try to think really carefully about the type of spaces you create, the facilities you need. And there was a moment where one of the designers, again, won't mention names, had a fair distance to commute in. And one of the offices we looked at, was one of the options, was a little bit further away than where we currently were. It meant an extra 10 minutes on that person's journey. And I clearly remember them saying to me, oh, do we really have to move there? Because it's 10 more minutes. And okay, so you've got an hour and a half journey already. And that is still, you know, that's painful. But already the conditions were set there, which were saying, you know, the only way to be able to afford to be in a major city was to live further out. And so you already had the dynamic where most people were thinking there's got to be a better way, a better quality of life, a better balance. So I think, yeah, the 3 days a week is highly likely, because it does give you the ability to do the things you desperately need to do above and beyond your job. And design can be incredibly intense. It can be all consuming, but every now and again, you have to do things like your washing. And how can you do that when you're stuck down here in like a hotel or whatever it is? So I think already the dynamic is there, ready for change. So COVID has basically just sped it up far more. And I think the question now is, what is an office space? How do you create the right? And everyone's looking into it. Are they hubs, social hubs? But I think the most important thing is the fact that there is a place to share.
You need a workshop, and you need bits of kit, and you know, not everyone has the luxury to have that in their student flat or something, you know. So there's those things as well, you know, 3D printers and stuff that people, not everyone has access to in their own.
I'd love to see something where you could get a membership to a kind of a club where there's a big workshop and it's huge. It's got all the stuff you need. You can go and use it. You can book time on it. Same as you've got at a uni where you don't have to buy all the things. I mean, that sounds to me.
Are we work for creatives?
Yeah. Almost like a shared office kind of studio space where you can go and hang out. I know there are a few bits and pieces like that, but I don't know of anything around, certainly not around here. I mean, geez, I'm in the wilderness. But, just a big workshop for doing your woodwork, plastic work, metal work, all of that. And, of course, you know, your bank of milling machines. It'd be amazing. I mean, it'd be a hell of an expensive thing to set up. Sure. In the wrong place. You're not going to get any business.
Yeah, I don't know how expensive it will be to set up. I think that there's probably a surplus of machinery around at the moment anyway. And that, there's a good sort of secondhand market as well. And that, we're just with the workshops we have here, it's all being redone over the summer. And we've sort of done a fairly extensive review of what machinery is actually needed. And again, another viewpoint, particularly from an educational perspective, this last year I've seen more creativity than I have done in 5 years because of the lack of access to machinery. It's meant that they've had to work around a problem without being able to quickly make something or to do something accurately. It's just as important to say, how can I work this problem? How can I get something that looks turned when I can't turn it? What other tools can I make? What can I create myself to help me make the thing I need to make? So this, I think there's been an increased level of creativity that's coming through in the work because of the restrictions of that lack of access. However, I think your idea is great, Drew. I mean, it would be superb to be able to get maybe these as Fab Labs did, but do it for the more physical rather than the digital. It would be superb. Mm-hmm. Really nice thing.
Right. Well, if anyone, any venture capitalists want to get in touch with you, it's hello@designtruth.co.uk. This episode is brought to you by our sponsors, INEO Solutions. INEO are a business transformation provider and a platinum reseller of PTC and Keyshot. If you hit the link ineo.co.uk/designtruth, it does help the podcast out quite a bit. So please do hit the link.
Yeah, I won't keep you any much longer, but do go and have a look. Go and check out their training, because it will make the difference between your portfolio and the one before it and the one after it that your next hiring manager is looking at.
Good stuff. Now back to the podcast.
We should get to the listening question, shouldn't we, Brad?
Yeah, I was just going to say, we put something up on our Instagram a couple of days ago, and the question was, how can industry work closer with education? So for the next 30 seconds, I'm just going to ramble a load of thoughts, not from me, but from designers to you, Paul. And then maybe you can take one or two of these that you might want to answer or give your kind of perspective on. Had some very interesting kind of views, and I'll share a couple of them with you now. I won't mention names because I don't want their employers to find out.
You can go and find them on Instagram.
Exactly. They follow us on Instagram. So there's, you can, there's a 1 in 2,000 chance of tracking these people down. So how can industry work close with education? Courses are vague as companies vary. Special modules for studio or in-house? I think the biggest problem I see is a lack of industry experience within education. Reach out to industry more. I think most people are happy to impart knowledge and expertise. So almost flipping it on its head. Make industry experience mandatory before graduating? More accessible and paid internships. Not every student can afford to work for free.
Yeah.
I'd also like us to think about industry working with students directly in some capacity. And then someone's put here, issue is less about how industry can work with education, but more why education won't work with industry. So those are the points that have been put through to us on our Instagram. When you was working in industry, Paul, has your thoughts and opinions on design education changed since you've gone to the dark side?
Yeah. The mildly introverted side. Yeah. No, it has. It has. And I'm beginning to realise that when I was asked to take on this role, and they talked about industry experience, you know, I don't think it's about coming in and talking about everything you've dealt with in the past. I think it's more of a reflection upon how can education help feed into industry more effectively. In fact, the previous dean who interviewed me pretty much said that, you know, it's be really important in your role to be able to close that gap. And I hadn't realized how big a gap it was. Now, I think a much healthier view now. When certainly when I was in industry, I used to get, how many CVs a week? I don't want to say, because if you then calculate how much time I had to look at them, you begin to get a horrible, horrible percentage. And I spent my time, and all of us in the team would be looking for this phrase, the best candidates. I've got to really not like that phrase. And I still hear it with some of our industry contacts now. Who are your best candidates? And the question for me is, what does best mean? Right? I mean, I've scribbled it down because it really has struck me just how I don't think industry and education are that far apart at all. Mm-hmm. I think there's a dynamic that needs changing. I think there's a re-education needed on both sides. I don't believe the purpose of us as design educators is to be feeding skills to an industry that is very commercially driven. So as a consequence, it's all about financial growth. How can we grow the business? How can we increase profit? That side, that's what I was used to in industry. Everything was about profit, the bottom line. When I've spent so much time in education, I've really recognized now the value of the creative growth. And I feel that one of the conversations we need to have between education and industry is how do you want to grow creatively? There are, for me, I know it's a lot of students, let's say 90 students a year coming out of here with some really diverse and unique viewpoints and perspectives. Now, when we, there's so many things that were raised in here and it's hard to tackle them all separately. We do have internships.
Yeah, don't feel free to do them all. Maybe just, you know, there's any particular ones that you just...
But they're all so connected. I mean, it's just the fact that, yes, we do work directly with industry, and I'm amazed at how fantastic those industry partners have been. Yes, we do keep going on about making sure there are paid internships. But I do feel that the students have so much more value than supporting the growth objectives of either the agency or the corporation they're working for. They have foresight, and they have currency in understand that future world that we're all going to be trying to work and deliver to. And I don't think that's truly recognized within industry. So let me give one other example. We know statistically, we've been measuring this one, students who come from perhaps the tougher backgrounds. Sorry, excuse that. Someone is trying to call me.
You're a busy guy, Paul.
He's one of the students. I feel terrible now. Those who come from backgrounds that have not had this exposure to the type of opera, it's the first day I'm quieter. Yeah, those who haven't had the exposure to the industry, maybe don't have parents in the creative industries, they really, really benefit from internships. Mm-hmm. Now, they may not be the best designers. That's because they don't have, they haven't had so much time to develop their skills. They have the potential to be the best designers, and they need that industry expertise, that industry experience to be able to help them shine. But I can say that as many times as I like, is like, how many of the students would you like to come and work with you? Because we've got a real wide range of viewpoints and diversity here that would really benefit you. And the answer is, yeah, I get that. That's fantastic. Who's your best student? I mean, we've got to break that somehow, because it's also setting up a dynamic where we are assessing people upon maybe the outcome of a project. And perhaps I can clarify this while here, and I've got this sort of forum. One of the, I won't say it's a misunderstanding, but the conversations indicate perhaps not quite the same perspective. When we do industry projects, we may have a situation where the industry, sorry about that. Well, that's a problem with the cable.
Don't worry, the edit there would be miraculous, don't worry.
the industry guys would say, really love that project. They say it to the student, what a fantastic project, love it, brilliant. It's so marketable. And we've given it a D. And then we're in this terrible position where the student's saying, well, hang on a minute, look, these guys that have run this, written the brief, are saying it's amazing, but you've only given me a D. And you know, students are also thinking, outcome, look what I created. But we aren't evaluating how good the idea is. I use good very loosely. We're evaluating the process the student's gone through. How much have they put into the full design process to make them highly capable? They may hit a naturally, intuitively, a brilliant idea, and the client absolutely loves it. But we still can't evaluate them by saying, love it. To the point where we've even suggested we might have to have an extra marking criteria that says, do I love it? Because actually we're not evaluating that at all. So I do think the idea of best usually means looking at a folio and seeing something that you really like for some reason. And that's the gap. That's where we need to have more conversations between academia and industry. What is best?
And do you think this kind of forum is a good way to start having those conversations? Because
I'd welcome it completely.
I don't know what
I'm
else
hidden
there
away
is
in this world.
Yeah,
I'm stuck in this sort of building with no windows, and so it could be quite. You say about isolation, Drew, but
panel discussion or something like that. I think we're long overdue a panel discussion, like we did with the students at the start of the year, where we get a few people on from both sides, and probably people who don't necessarily represent big companies or design agencies, but are just right in the middle of the people who are, you know, recent graduates looking for that piece of work to try and get down. I think it needs that triangular discussion of, like, from their point of view, here's my frustration, here's where I think I've been let down, or where I feel like I haven't got enough of this, or where they're asking for the wrong things, or whatever it might be. And then, you know, for university to describe, well, to paraphrase, our role is not to get you hired. Our role is to educate you in design and to train you and plenty more besides. And then obviously from a business point of view, well, yeah, but great, I need someone who can come in now and I can have confidence that I can give them some small amount of autonomy so that I can carry on doing my bit. And it would be, I don't know what that way is of being able to demonstrate trustworthiness and process and all these sort of things without a decent looking portfolio. And it's massively frustrating, because that final couple of pictures, you know, two or three images and a little few notes doesn't describe, here's my documentation process, here's my approach to risk. Those are the kind of things where I think if you've got a good approach to risk as a student and a really solid nailed on process, I'm not really interested in what you made. That's cool, but it's by the by. I want to know if I give you a piece of work, whatever it might be, how are you going to go tackle it? And I don't know how. I haven't seen anything yet as either an applicant or as a hiring manager where I've gone, got you. I understand that. I don't think I've even communicated it myself, other than, you know, when you do sort of presentations at conferences and say, you know, put up a PowerPoint slide about 13485. If someone sent me that as a portfolio, I would just die of yawning. but that's probably the bit. That's probably the bit of value, isn't it? So, yeah, I think it does need a proper forum. Because the one thing I know that's come up a couple of times on the podcast as well. Actually, I did want to mention this, was some of the modules that I don't know what's covered in your course, but we quite often get asked about how much business education is in there, is in design education at the moment. How much technical side of things like the maths and the physics and the engineering. What about business? What about creativity? All of these sort of things. I'm sure that varies. I don't expect you to be able to add to that for every design course. There must be about a couple of hundred design courses now, right, in the UK?
Yeah. Was it 67 courses, I think, in the UK?
67 courses.
Yeah.
Average. I mean, we've seen one course that had a couple of hundred students about to graduate. Blew my mind that there's those kind of numbers. Don't mean that as any criticism or praise or anything in between. It's just I was shocked.
Do you think that's part of the problem? I don't know, you probably won't be able to, maybe not best by, you might not need to want to give your opinion on it, but if there's too many students going through the system in comparison to the amount of jobs that are available,
another misunderstanding, actually. Right, so I actually checked this before this call because I wanted to get my facts right. 87% of our students go on to design jobs or study MAs.
Okay.
Further design education. 87%. Now, how many of those students go into traditional product design or industrial design roles? I'd need to look at in more detail. And it is considerably lower, for sure.
Yeah. But that's not your job, is it? That's not your job, is it, to get them a traditional industrial design job? It just shows the power of the skill set that you learn from a design degree, though, and you can get employment.
It does. I mean, it is a combination. I want students to get into the industry because I think it's an incredibly empowering industry. I think it's been misunderstood for too long. I think the power of the physical is phenomenal, and the engagement with the tangible really makes a difference to all sorts of human interactions. But yeah, you're right. At the same time, coming back to this sort of creative attributes, what we are doing is preparing students to have the right attitudes to be able to get roles within a range of potential jobs. A few have gone into sort of design journalism. Many have gone on to the whole digital arena. But you know, as you just saying, Drew, I mean, one of the attributes is proactivity. So if you really want to do well in a design career, and having a degree of autonomy and be able to take responsibility for the task you've been set is a personal attribute as opposed to a skill. Yep. And that, to me, has always been the same. And I always reflect upon one guy I interviewed in the Samsung days who I had no idea what he was talking about. He'll know who he is if he's listening in. I just remember sitting in the interview and thinking, you're just talking about a whole load of stuff I don't understand. And that was the big but. I really like the way you're saying it. The enthusiasm was phenomenal. Took a risk, and the whole office actually changed direction as a consequence of his employment, because he took us into a different arena, and you could totally trust him with it. You gave him the task, he'd go away and he'd come back with something better every single time. And people like that are so incredibly valuable. He had quite a few traditional product design skills as well, but he was really heavily involved in sort of digital work and engineering of digital products. Fantastic difference it made to the business. And it's that, I guess that's what I'm asking with industry. Open your minds. You're not just responding to clients. If your agency side, your responsibility isn't just to deliver that brief. It's always that extra 20% you can give. Where does that 20% come from? It doesn't come from looking backwards at what you've done in the past. It has to be about what you're looking towards and the perspective you have on what's coming. And that, for me, is where students have the value. That's where the graduates can bring you that perspective.
Yeah, and I think to reflect back, just to play advocate for the industry as the hiring managers there, we want that to be really clear from students. I need to be challenged by the juniors and by the, you know, I want the rest of my team to be able to say, like, right from day one, I think you've got this bit wrong, or like, why did you not do this piece? Whatever it is, even if we have a good answer for it, I need someone to be able to ask me questions. Otherwise, we might not ask them.
Yeah.
So when, any advice for the students would be, I mean, and not to be so direct about it, but it would be make it clear where your passion is and where you think your attributes are, not just in the portfolio, but in yourself and what you bring to a team.
One of the agencies that we talked to, and it wasn't a conversation I had, but one of my colleagues, Magnus Long, he sort of mentioned how one of those agencies is now asking, really employing people based on attitude. They just assume everyone has the skills. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 67 courses in the UK teaching the same sort of skills. What makes a difference to industry and in employing graduates? Well, it's the attitude for sure. So I think that it's noted with industry, and I see that changing. And you still need the skills to be strong, but yeah, ultimately, if you can communicate effectively through an interview process or maybe just networking, the attributes that one has, that, I mean, it could work against you. I mean, if you have a really specific attitude, it just might not fit.
Yeah, you're not on everyone's Christmas card list. It's just the way exactly. It's just the way it works.
Yeah, square pegs, round pegs, yeah. And just blancmanges that will kind of conform. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. We do like to finish every episode with a particular question, Paul. And I don't know if you've listened to many of our episodes, but the question is, what is the strangest brief you've ever come across?
Now, the most bizarre project I've ever had, and this is what I love about design. I used to do a lot of work out in India, and the brief that came to me was design a fridge with a radio in it. A fridge with a radio in it. Is that seriously a brief? Why? And I was asking the questions why. I said, oh, we'd like to have a fridge with a radio in it. And it's, you know, it always goes back to the whole period where we used to get random products coming out of the Far East that just seemed really sensible to do a CD player stroke toaster. It was that kind of period.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, now, I read Dwarf, there was a talking toaster and it seemed so futuristic. Oh, sorry. I told you.
But the... I was the one that ended up having an egg on my face for sure, because when I got out there to do some of the market research, and my colleague at the time, Jason, who's Fisher and Paykel now, he used to have to sit and do all the CAD work while I did the meeting families and going to their homes and understanding context, doing some research questionnaires. I suddenly became very aware that when I was sat in people's homes in 45 degree heat in the middle of the day, people stopped. They'd lie down and just relax and try to get through the worst of the heat of the day. And they'd do that in their lounge as a family. Now, the fridge was nearly always in the lounge. That's because there's a cultural context there. Is the drink one has in the morning, you collect milk in the morning, you put it in the fridge, all very specific. That, of course, you want to drink whilst in the middle of the day to cool down. And because of the amount of power theft in India, so if you've ever been to India, you'll see this with the power lines. There's just cables hanging from these poles because people steal the power. And then the energy companies come along and cut the power and they steal it. It's like a maypole. If you have problems with power and you have a generator to cover that loss of power, then the fridge is the one thing you're going to make sure you have power going to. So if you have power to your fridge to be able to have cool drinks throughout the day, why wouldn't you have power to a radio to listen to something whilst you're relaxing in the middle of the day? So, yes, of course, you have a radio in the fridge. Now, it's so obvious once you've been there, but from a distance, you know, a couple of thousand miles away, it didn't make sense at all. Yeah. It was actually a really enjoyable project for sure. But my first first response to it was like, really? Have I got to go through a whole sort of educating the client about design on this one? But no, they were absolutely open-minded, and it was absolutely brilliant. But it was a bizarre brief when I first read it.
Yeah, yeah.
That just shows, outcome. Isn't it, that you can, a brief comes through and you might think this is ridiculous, but it's a lived experience, isn't it? And I suppose it's helpful for you when you went out there and got to experience it firsthand. It was great to invite you on, Paul. Thanks for spending the last hour with us. I hope you enjoyed it. And
very much.
As I've said to you before, I'm sure I'll send this out to Drew, but if you do need our support with anything, I'm sure me and Drew will be happy to help in any way we can for the students.
Yeah. There is one thing I'd like to promote, if that's all right. It's just the fact that we've tried to do speed dating with industry for quite a few years, and we tended to do it around the degree show. This year, we actually, as you know, we did actually have a physical show. It's been amazing, honestly. Absolutely, just bloody hard work, totally unexpected. Nearly got killed by Boris, but we did it. And it's been the response from industry has been absolutely fantastic. I'm over the moon with this one. But we, not being able to do this sort of speed dating with industry last year, we kind of wanted to do it this year. We're still restricted. So we're doing an online dating instead. So I'm going to invite a whole load of industry people I know to join us on a Miro board. Give them a task of looking at maybe just six students' work that we will say probably in your territory. And then get them just to look at those six. And they have the freedom to look at any other work if they want to. But just to be able to then feedback, just a post-it note at the bottom that says, like the work for, think it'd be more interesting if you did this, maybe you could improve upon here. So we're going to do that. I've got a list of people I'm going to contact, but if there is anyone else out there that wants to be involved in that one, then please let me know, because I would absolutely really relish the opportunity to get more industry people directly engaged with all of the students, not just the best.
Yeah, absolutely.
Using the best to gain that loose turn.
Cool. Yeah. When's this happening?
We're building it right now. I'm probably going to start emailing companies this afternoon.
Okay.
We're hoping to do it next week.
Okay, cool.
It can be ongoing.
Cool. We'll make sure to get this episode up and running, get the edit done for Friday or something. And then, absolute pleasure as always, Paul. And I'm sure I'll see you for a drink at some point in the year, as long as you're not isolating. Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Design Truth. As always, if you ever want to be on an episode, track us down on the socials or hello@designtruth.co.uk. We'll try and get a few more episodes to you over the next couple of weeks, but we are entering this holiday stroke annual leave season, so we'll see what we can do. A reminder that this podcast is sponsored by INEO Solutions, and you can find out more about how you can get your hands on a £100 discount to your key shop, PTC or software training by heading to the link ineo.co.uk/designtruth. Now it's time to leave you to some equally funky outro music, and I'll see you next time.